Welcome to this Ubula Audio presentation of The Golden Skull by John Blaine, the pen name for the writer Harold Goodwin. This is your narrator, Jim Campanella. The Golden Skull is the 10th Rick Brandt book and is one of the more adventure-oriented rather than scientifically-oriented volumes in the series, although there is certainly science. Mind you, that science is archaeology, much like the Indiana Jones movies. Rick and Scotty fly off to the Philippines with Dr. Tony Briotti to search for the titular Golden Skull. Of course, things do not go smoothly, or quite predictably. Before we begin our story, I have to make my customary commentary on the awful cover artwork that accompanies this volume. First, the usual. Scotty and Rick look about 12. I guess I'm used to that by now. I'm sure it was an instruction that was given to the artist by the publisher.
We're trying to appeal to kids. Don't make Rick and Scotty look 18 or 19, even though they are. 12-year-olds won't buy the book because they won't identify.
Furthermore, Scotty is leering at the Golden Skull as if he had just scanned some girl's phone number, and Rick's expression is just lame and kind of brainless. The second issue with the cover is Dr. Tony Briotti is described in the book as being young and athletic, looking like he was still in college. The cover drawing makes Tony look like a middle-aged professor of no athletic ability. It's inaccurate, and worse, the stupid smile on Tony's face makes him look like he's got serious mental deficiencies. And what is with the hot dog on a stick he's carrying? Did the artist even read the book? And now, The Golden Skull. Chapter 1. The Headhunter. It was hot in the cabin of the freighter, Asiatic Dream. The heaviness of the tropical heat outside the ship penetrated through the steel and flaking paint of the deck to turn the cabin into an oven. Rick Brandt and Don Scott, stripped to their shorts, were oblivious of the heat. They sat hunched over a three-dimensional chessboard, studying the complex moves of their newest hobby. Now and then they glared at each other, or paused to wipe the sweat from their faces or arms, but otherwise they concentrated on the three-layer board and the chessmen. The rivalry was intense, and had been ever since Hartson Brandt, Rick's distinguished scientist's father, had introduced them to the game back home on Spindrift Island. Watching them was Dr. Anthony Briotti, clad in tropical tan shorts and nothing else. He looked like a college athlete. Little about him suggested he was an archaeologist with an international reputation. Presently he rose and left the cabin, heading for the deck. He didn't bother to say where he was going. He knew the boys wouldn't even notice. On the deck, Briotti leaned against the rail and peered ahead to where the rocky fortress of Corregidor loomed at the mouth of Manila Bay. His pulse beat faster at the sight of the famous island. He knew its outline. He had commanded a destroyer during World War II. Even though the faint light of a new moon shone only vague outlines, he recognized the old Spanish prison rock below the overhang of Corregidor, and he remembered that his guns had blasted at the Japanese from that very point. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw a shadow move fleetingly. He turned, but saw nothing. Then, because he was busy with his memories, he turned back to the dim, haunting view of Corregidor and thought no more about it. Below, Rick Brandt moved his king diagonally across the three-dimensional chessboard and said triumphantly, "Checkmate!" Scotty rose, drew back one muscular leg as though to kick the set into the air, and then grinned. "Well, I had let you win. Bad for morale to lose all the time. Next time I'll teach you how to lose. Rick snorted. You let me win like a mother bear would let me walk off with her cubs. It's my remarkable intellect that won that game and nothing else.
Won by your wits, eh?
Scotty mopped his wet face. And you're only half-armed. Rick shied a chess man at him.
Wait until we teach this game to Chada.
Scotty chuckled. He'll probably beat us both at once. Then we'll find out he learned how to play from the latest edition of the World Almanac. Chada, their Hindu friend, had learned about America by memorizing an old copy of the Almanac, and he quoted from it at every opportunity. Since their first meeting in Bombay, years before, the Indian boy had been with them on several expeditions. Now he was to meet them in Manila to help them in their search for one of ancient history's most fabulous treasures. Rick, a tall, slim young man with light brown hair and brown eyes, led the way up the ladder to the deck. Scotty, bigger and slightly darker in coloring, followed close behind. They walked toward the bow, searching for Briati, their eyes not yet accustomed to the darkness. Rick called out,
Tony?
Here by the rail, the archaeologist answered. The boys moved toward him, but someone, or something, moved faster. A shadowy form sped past them, and Rick's quick eye caught the flash of light on steel, and he yelled, Look out! Tony moved, and a steel blade clanged off the ship's rail. Rick and Scotty leapt forward, grasping for the shadow. The steel blade lifted again. Scotty grabbed her wrist and twisted. The blade clattered to the deck. Rick got his arms around a sweaty waist and squeezed, bracing his feet to lift the man off the deck. Then an elbow caught him in the Adam's apple and flooded his eyes with tears of pain. He loosened his grip involuntarily and felt the man squirm free. Scotty yelled, Get him! Tony Briati swung a roundhouse right that missed and sent him sprawling off balance. Then the assailant was at the rail, poised. Scotty lunged for his ankle as the man dived cleanly out and away from the ship into the dark water. The three rushed to the rail, watching for the swimmer.
Man overboard!
Tony's voice lifted in a shout that brought the crew running. For a few moments there was confusion as the officers and crew tried to find out what had happened. Then the searchlight on the bridge was manned, and its white beam cut the water. There was no swimmer, but off toward Bataan Peninsula, the light reflected from the patched sail of a banca, an outrigger canoe, sailing toward shore with a bone in its teeth. A few moments later, the three spindrifters stood in the captain's office, staring at a Filipino bolo, a long, slightly curved machete with a square tip. Tony hefted it and shuddered. If you hadn't yelled, well, this thing landed right where my head had been a second before.
If I hadn't said anything, Rick replied, it wouldn't have been anywhere near your neck. I put the finger on you by calling your name.
Scotty snapped his fingers.
Of course. That guy must have been in hiding until he heard us call. Then, when you answered, he knew you were the one he was after, and he went for you.
Tony stared incredulous.
But why? I can't imagine why a mountain Igorot would be aboard the ship for the express purpose of killing me.
It was Rick's turn to stare.
How did you know he was an Igorot?
Either an Igorot or an Ifugwe, Tony replied. I caught a glimpse of his head as he jumped onto the rail. That haircut is distinctive. It looks as though a bowl had been put on the head and all the hair removed that it didn't cover.
Rick knew that an Igorot was a primitive native of the Philippine mountain province. All of them had received a series of lectures on Philippine ethology from Tony before leaving home. The Igorots bore roughly the same relationship to the regular Filipinos as Native Americans did to the white Americans. Ifugwe natives were much like the Igorots, but with a slightly more advanced culture. They too lived in the mountain province, the objective of the Spindrift expedition. The trip had grown out of an earlier expedition to Kwangara Island in the western Pacific. Dr. Anthony Briati had helped translate the tablets found in the sunken temple of Alta Yuan and had discovered the connection between the early people of the Philippines, of whom the Igorots and the Ifugwos were the descendants, and the white dragon worshippers of Alta Yuan. One plaque from the sunken temple had described the Ifugwe rice terraces of Mountain Province in unmistakable detail, and had also described a skull of gold, which was said to have magic properties. Tony Briatti had been so enthusiastic about locating this fabulous skull and proving the connection between Alta Yuan and the Philippines that Hartson Brandt, head of the Spindrift Foundation, had made arrangements for the small expedition. None of the other Spindrift scientists could be spared, so Tony Briatti had only Rick and Scotty as his assistants. Chada was supposed to join them in Manila. The boys thought that was help aplenty. No other helpers were needed.
"I don't believe it," Tony stated. "It is simply beyond possibility that an Igorot could have boarded this ship with the express intention of killing me. More likely, he boarded the ship to steal, thought he was discovered, and headed for the rail where his banca was tied. I was in his way. That's it."
"No one saw the banca approach," the ship's captain said. "But of course, it could have. We've been traveling at only a few knots, and the banca could have approached from the stern, thrown a line over the rail and tied up. Dangerous, but a clever native could do it. They're like cats. They make fine sailors," he added. "Never heard of it being done before, but there's no reason to think it was an attempt at murder. Thieves in the Orient are willing to take long chances."
Rick stared through the port at the lights of Manila. He was very thoughtful. Let Tony try to brush the incident aside. He knew better. He knew it in his bones. There was trouble ahead for the Spindrifters. He caught Scotty's worried frown. He knew his pal's thoughts were the same. Chapter 2. Manila After Dark. Out of the Asiatic Dream's forward hold swung the sleek shape of an airplane fuselage. Rick bristled with nervous energy as he watched. He yelled,
"Watch it! Take it easy with that winch!"
Scotty patted him on the shoulder.
"Take it easy yourself before you pop a gusset. They're doing fine."
Rick didn't take his eyes off the plane.
"Okay, but if they drop it, we'll hike into the mountains instead of flying. Hey, you, lift it! Lift it clear of the rail!"
The plane was Rick's new sky wagon, a powerful little four-place job that had replaced his beloved cub, wrecked by saboteurs. It had less than 10 hours flying time, and he didn't want it wrecked by having a careless winchman bash it against something. But in spite of his fears, the fuselage was lowered safely onto the waiting truck. The wings and their crates were brought out, and in a short time, the boys were riding with the plane out to Manila International Airport. The day was still young. The freighter had anchored off the Manila port area during the night, berthing in the early hours. The Spindrift party had checked into the Manila hotel, and Tony, leaving the boys to supervise the unloading and clearance of their equipment, had gone off to the University of the Philippines. Now the crates of equipment were in the customs shed waiting to be picked up, and the plane was en route to the airport to be assembled. Everything was going smoothly, except...
"Chada," Rick mused. "Where do you suppose he went?" "The day I can figure out Chada's comings and goings is the day I polish my crystal ball and solve the rest of the world's mysteries. He's probably off somewhere studying the World Almanac."
Chada had been registered at the Manila Hotel, but had checked out 3 days before their arrival. He had left no forwarding address and no message.
"He's probably somewhere in the Indian colony of Manila," Rick speculated. "Quite a few Indians here, mostly Hindus. They call them Bombays," Tony said.
"He'll show up. He always does. Wonder how Tony's making out."
Tony had gone to see a colleague, a Filipino archaeologist by the name of Dr. Remedios Ocola. It was through Ocola that arrangements had been made with the Philippine government for their expedition, or would be made. Their permit had not yet been issued.
"I didn't know they had a university here," Scotty added, "until Tony started ratting to this Filipino scientist."
"You should read the stuff Tony brought," Rick replied. "The Philippines has dozens of universities."
Scotty grinned.
Well, Chad has probably taken a course at one of them, getting a degree of DD. Rick took the bait. What is that? Doctor of Divinity? Doctor of Dentistry? Neither. Dean of Disappearances. Rick groaned. Still, it was true. Chada was the most disappearing person they'd ever known. The truth was, as he well knew, Chada loved the dramatic. The little Hindu boy thoroughly enjoyed baffling his pals with theatrical appearances and disappearances. Not that he did his vanishing act just for fun, however. There was usually a good reason. Arrangements had been made by mail and confirmed by phone that morning for hangar space at Manila International Airport. While giant trans-Pacific passenger liners landed or took off, and while the busy twin-engined island hoppers of Philippines Airlines kept the field active, the boys assembled the Sky Wagon. Even allowing for Rick's pride of ownership, the Sky Wagon was a beauty. It was painted pure white with a red stripe along the fuselage. It could carry four, plus a fair amount of cargo. It had flaps, which permitted slow landings and short takeoffs. And it had retractable landing gear and a variable pitch propeller. Under the rear seats was a special feature, a small hatch through which a winch-driven cable could be operated. This was a typical Rick Brandt labor-saving device. Back home, Rick was the errand boy for Spindrift Island, an island off the New Jersey coast where the famous Spindrift Foundation was located. Until he acquired the Sky Wagon, his grocery shopping meant landing at the Whiteside Airport, hiking into town, picking up the groceries, lugging them back, loading them onto the Cub, and then flying them back to Spindrift. Now he could phone in his order, get into the Sky Wagon, lower the weighted cable, and swoop low over the grocery store, which was located on the outskirts of Whiteside. The hook at the end of the cable snagged another cable hung between two steel poles on the roof of the store. The sack of groceries, it was a special strong canvas sack, were on the cable and needed only to be reeled into the plane. It worked really well. The only trouble was that Rick had never collected eggs intact. The shock of the pickup was a little too much. When he solved that problem, he would make arrangements with the electronic supply house in Newark to let him put in the same kind of rig. Eventually, he hoped he would get so efficient he would never have to land on the mainland except to deliver a passenger or pay a personal visit. Rick and Scotty checked the plane over with the greatest of care, and then Rick got in and started the engine. He let it warm up, watching his instruments. Everything was fine. He motioned to Scotty, who was watching and listening from outside. Scotty got in, and Rick taxied to the end of the runway. While he revved up the engine, Scotty obtained takeoff permissions from the control tower, and in a few moments they were airborne, enjoying the sudden drop in temperature. "First time I've stopped sweating in a week," Scotty said. Rick nodded and motioned to pump up the landing gear. The hydraulic system worked on a hand pump between the two front seats. It was not as satisfactory as a motor-driven pump, but it took no electric power and used up no valuable weight. Besides, a few strokes on the pump did the job. He leveled off at 5,000 feet above the city. Below, the Pasig River cut the city in half. They traced the line of the Great Wall around the Intramuros, the ancient walled city, and found the white mass of the American Embassy across Dewey Boulevard from some very modern apartments. They passed over the Manila Hotel, then saw the ruins of the infamous Fort Santiago. Inland, the land was lush green with high mountains rising in the distance. To the north lay Mountain Province, and behind the screen of mountains was their destination. There was still work to be done, so Rick reluctantly took the Sky Wagon down again. It was in perfect condition. No need for further flight. They lunched at a modern drive-in on Dewey Boulevard, the split-lane highway that runs along the edge of Manila Bay, then picked up their crates of supplies at customs. This was a light expedition, so there were only three crates. One held their camp gear and trail clothing. Another crate held Tony Briatti's special tools and reference books. The third held
the most important object of the expedition, the Spindrift Experimental Earth Scanner, called SEAS for short, and further abbreviated by the boys to a sibilant hiss. "How's the S working?" Scotty would ask, and Rick would answer, "Svine as can be." The boys were old hands at expeditions, and they had learned from bitter experience about the number of unexpected things that can happen at baggage. So, in spite of some opposition from the hotel clerk, they insisted on stowing the supplies in their room. This done, they got into bathing trunks and cooled off in the hotel pool. There was nothing to do now but wait for Tony and Chada. When they returned from their swim, a message was waiting, brought by a messenger from Tony Briatti. Rick read it, then handed it to Scotty. They were to have dinner with Tony's colleague, Okola, and an assistant secretary of the interior, Mr. Lozada, at the latter's house. Dinner was at 10. They were to arrive a half an hour early and wear dinner jackets.
"Dinner at 10? Scotty was stunned. "That's got to be a mistake. Nobody could live until that hour without food."
The desk clerk overheard the comment and smiled.
"Old Spanish custom, sir. Many Filipinos follow Spanish custom."
"That's very fine for those who are used to it," Rick said. "But here's one Americano who is not going to follow Filipinos who follow old Spanish customs."
"Two Americanos," Scotty corrected. "We will follow old American custom of snack early, English custom of dinner at 8, and then Spanish custom of dinner at 10. That way we get plenty chow, huh?"
This exchange was for their own benefit. The clerk did not overhear because they were hurrying to their rooms to change. It was too early to get into dinner jackets. They hauled out what Scotty called the penguin rigs and got into them. In spite of feeling a little self-conscious, they looked brown and handsome in their white tropical jackets and maroon bow ties. They found a table on the porch overlooking Manila Bay and the great field called the Luneta. By turning a little, Rick could see the traffic on Dewey Boulevard. Rick had never seen anything like it. Apparently, Filipino drivers were all mad at something, and all under the impression that no other vehicles were on the road. Also, Filipino drivers obviously had wild affection for their horns. They tooted constantly. "The life of a pedestrian must be less than 10 minutes in this town," Scotty commented. "Pedestrians are nothing but the raw material for accidents here," Rick agreed. "Look at that." Among the buses, the cars, and the jeeps that ranged the boulevard trotted a half dozen two-wheeled carriages drawn by tiny horses. These were the calesas of bygone days, still competing with Manila's countless taxis for passengers.
"We should hire two of those and have a chariot race," Scotty suggested.
They had a sandwich and cold drink made of calamansi, the pungent, small Filipino limes, and then walked across the boulevard to where the great wall of the old city rose high in the air. The wall was made of huge stone blocks, and it rose about 4 times the boy's height into the air. It was perhaps 20 feet thick at the base. Within the walls, there had once been a city of 100,000 people, but it was there that in World War II the Japanese had chosen to make their last stand. Most of the people of the city had been wiped out, along with their Japanese captors, and of the ancient buildings, only a cathedral remained. The area had been bulldozed flat in most places, and Quonset-type warehouses called bodegas had replaced the ruined Spanish buildings.
"Rick, look at this!"
Scotty called, pointing to a fern-like plant that grew near the wall.
"Watch!"
He touched it, and the leaves rolled into tight tubes.
"How about that, huh?"
A Filipino gentleman, immaculate in white nylon suit, watched them for a moment, then joined them.
"The plant is strange to Americans, I think. It is a sensitive mimosa. You have the mimosa in America, but not this variety."
"It's good of you to explain that, sir," Rick said.
"Not at all. In Tagalog, the plant is called makahiya. It means literally, 'I am ashamed when you touch me.'"
"It's a shame so it closes up," Rick said.
"Well, that's charming. Tagalog must be a picturesque language."
The Filipino nodded.
It has a certain flavor. Allow me to introduce myself. I am Colonel Felix Rojas of the Philippine Constabulary.
Rick took his first good look at the Filipino and immediately recognized soldierly bearing and lean fitness of the professional soldier. He introduced himself and Scotty. Colonel Rojas said,
"The young men who are going to dine with the esteemed Assistant Secretary tonight, Welcome to our country."
He bowed and walked away, leaving them open-mouthed. Then, as an afterthought, he turned.
"Surprised? Don't be. We are interested in strangers until their intentions are known. Yours are above reproach."
His smile faded.
"However, you may be interested in another bit of Tagalog."
He spoke briefly a phrase that seemed to be mostly vowels.
"What does that mean?" Scotty asked.
The colonel's eyes searched theirs.
"What good is hay to a dead horse?" he said, and walked away.
The boys stared at each other.
"Well, that's a very good question," Rick said at last.
The colonel had vanished into the Manila hotel.
"Scotty, what good is hay to a dead horse?"
"Well, the deceased equine has little use for hay," Scotty said.
"Obviously."
"Was that some kind of a warning?"
"I don't know what it was," Rick said. The phrase could have been a warning, but of what? And how had the colonel known where they were dining? He put the question aloud. Scotty shrugged.
"Doesn't the constabulary come under the Department of the Interior? Maybe Lozada told him. A colonel would be pretty high rank in the constabulary. Could even be a commander."
The Philippine constabulary had a long and distinguished history. It was similar to a police force, but it was more of a military organization. It was, Rick thought, something like a cross between the American State Militia, the Texas Rangers, and any good state police force.
"Well, I'm snowed," Rick said at last.
"The only thing I'm sure of is that he wasn't looking for information when he asked what good is hay to a dead horse. Come on, let's start for Lozada's."
The way led across busy Taft Avenue, named for the American president, across the Ayala Bridge, which spanned the Pasig River, and past the Malaccan Palace. The palace was the equivalent of our White House. In its time, Spanish, American, and Japanese conquerors of the Philippines had once lived there. Now it housed the president of the Republic of the Philippines. It was very dark by the time they passed the palace. They left the street-lit area and entered an area of old Spanish houses. The Pasig River was very close. They could smell the water hyacinth, which floated endlessly down to the sea. The air was heavy with unshed rain. The boys had long since shed their jackets and were carrying them. Now the heat seemed to push on them, muffling every sound of their leather soles on the cobbles. They passed a solitary street light, and Rick read the sign. They were on the right track. The hotel clerk's directions obtained before they ate had been very good.
"We're almost there," Rick whispered,
then wondered why he hadn't spoken aloud. Apparently, Scotty was feeling the same physical oppression, because he didn't comment on the whisper. The houses were two-story, old Spanish style, with much wrought iron fancy work. Few lights showed. Such houses presented only blank faces to the street. The life inside them found its open air and secluded patios in the rear.
"We must be getting close," Scotty said, voice low.
Rick unsnapped his key ring. It had a pencil flashlight attached. He shot the light over the house fronts, searching for a number. A cream-colored lizard darted frantically out of the circle of light and into the protecting darkness.
"Two more numbers," Rick said.
"It's got to be the house after the next one." He flashed the tiny light ahead and froze as he saw the shape of a man. Beside him, he felt Scotty tense. It was silly to stand frozen. Rick moved ahead. He moved slowly, and the shape took form. Turban, flowing tunic, with sash, fiercely whiskered face. A Sikh guard. He breathed a sigh of relief. Sikhs. Indians. They were noted for their bravery and fighting ability. and they can be found in most cities of the Far East, usually employed as private guards or police. The Sikh came to attention, and Rick noted he was rather small for his race. Most Sikhs were big men. He had kept the light on his bearded face, noting that the beard was neatly tied in the Sikh fashion. Brown eyes stared unblinking, and the hoarse voice said,
"This is house of Mr. Secretary Lazada. Please enter."
Suddenly the voice changed, and Rick nearly jumped out of his skin.
"Go right up the stairs, meatheads. Scotty must be hungry. He always is."
Rick choked.
"Chada?"